Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today with a high reaching up to 112. 107 is average for today. We hit 109 for a high yesterday. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. Sunny at 112 tomorrow, 111 on Saturday. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 106 degrees. Arizona's Division of Child Support Services is taking a unique approach when it comes to collecting back child support. The agency is hosting a phone-a-thon. Gerald Richard is with the Department of Economic Security.
And the purpose of the phone-a-thon is for individuals to call in order to get back on track as far as their child support payments and to avoid any court action and let us work with them in order that we can help their families and also make them whole again.
In May, the DCSS hosted a similar event and collected more than $32 million in child support. The phone lines will be open until 3 p.m.
The new Phoenix police chief was formally introduced to the public today. Jerry Williams, who'd been a member of the Phoenix PD for 22 years before leaving to become chief in Oxnard, California, will be the first female African-American to lead the department when she takes over from Chief Joe Yonner after his October retirement. KJZZ's Stina Sieg had the chance to sit down with Jerry Williams and joins me now. Stina, so much is going on. How did you start your conversation?
One of the first things that we talked about were feelings on the protests in response to the recent killings of Black men across the country, like the one last Friday here in Phoenix.
As a police professional and having been one for 28 years, the unique dynamic of law enforcement is we're the only profession that even when you're protesting us, we are there to protect you and your right to peacefully assemble. So we're there to uphold one's First Amendment rights. So if you think about the protest last week, if you think about the one that's going to happen tomorrow, what you will see are men and women in blue standing there protecting others' rights. And I know that that's what we're supposed to do.
What's the best way for, you know, the African-American community, including Black Lives Matter, to interact with the police and just the community in general to interact with the police?
I do think we all bear some responsibility for the dynamics going on in our country right now as law enforcement and community as one, because I don't think we're separate. We've lost the ability to have face-to-face conversations like you and I are having now. Oftentimes you will see social media tweets, emails, other things, and you almost lose that sense of civility. I think it's time to bring back face-to-face conversations. I think it's time to bring back conversations of how we're similar rather than how we're different. I do know that everyone in the community wants pretty much one thing often. Don't you want to feel safe in your community? I want to feel safe in mine. So how can we get to that? And how can we as law enforcement work on regaining and building that trust in the community? What I think I bring to this job is the ability to bridge that gap. I'm a woman of color. I have men of color in my house and have raised two amazing sons, by the way. I had to give a shout out to Alan and Cody. But it's literally having discussions and conversations about how can we as a community get better in denouncing violence, because violence is not the way. You talked about Black Lives Matter. I do believe that Black Lives Matter, but I also believe that all lives matter. So how can we as a community bridge that gap and provide safety and security for everyone in our community?
Right now, the Phoenix police are investigating a possible serial killer. How are you going to handle that? And have you ever dealt with anything like that before in your career?
So how am I going to handle it? We're going to continue to do what the Phoenix Police Department is doing now. I have the utmost confidence in the abilities of those detectives and those law enforcement officers who are seeking justice for those victims. When I was in the city manager's office, and this was years ago as a commander, the baseline shooter was active, so have dealt with the dynamic, not directly, but indirectly. To me, someone knows something. So we need that person to come out, even if it's anonymously through silent witness, to make those connections so our detectives can do what they need to do and we will find who's responsible.
Now, our police department has been understaffed for a while now. What is your plan moving forward on that?
So it's my understanding that Chief Yonner and the current staff at the Park Department is working tirelessly to try to find people to fill those seats in those patrol cars to answer those calls for service, while at the same time maintaining a high standard of hire. We hold our officers to a higher standard. I think the beauty of me being the police chief, perhaps someone may not have thought about being a police officer before, and she may see me and say, hey, maybe that's something that I could do, or he may say, hey, that's pretty awesome that she's there, maybe I can do it. So utilizing all of our tools that we have in our community, reaching out to the community, asking the community to bring people to us to be police officers, I know for a fact that that's the way to increase the hiring pool.
So, Stina, you talked about a lot of serious stuff. Anything else come up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she said she's truly honored and truly humbled to have this job. And when I asked her what she had missed most about being in Phoenix, she said the diversity of ethnic food here.
KJZZ Stina Sieg had the chance to talk with the soon-to-be police chief of Phoenix, Jerry Williams. Stina, thanks.
Thank you.
The Phoenix Police Department's listening tour came to Maryvale last night. It's part of a citywide effort to hear from residents about a series of recommendations made by a panel tasked with improving trust between the agency and Phoenicians. Last night's discussion came days after police referred to a series of unsolved homicides in the area as serial shootings for the first time. Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau was at the meeting and is with me now. And Matt, what did the Citizens Committee recommend as far as changes in the police department?
So they came up with 15 suggestions for the police department. Most have already been or soon will be implemented. But police say some of them would require policy changes, which means mayor and council approval. Marshall Franklin is Phoenix's director of police community relations. She's been at all of the listening sessions and says community turnout has been good.
Some of it is very tough messages, but they are the tough messages that we need to hear as a department so that we can increase and improve and enhance trust and the relationships between our department and the communities we serve.
Matt, what did Maryvale residents have to say about some of these proposals?
Well, about 10 people spoke at the meeting. One of the things that several focused on was a suggestion that volunteers teach people, especially young children, how to interact with police. Several people were very angry about that and said that the police are here to serve the people, not the other way around. Vita Hernandez was one of the speakers, and she's with the Center for Neighborhood Leadership. She said the policy changes are exactly what's needed, but she's not optimistic they'll happen.
I feel that it is really easy to hold these and, you know, use them to extend the timeline and use them as band-aids to actually not get to the work of implementing.
How do these suggestions relate to concerns residents have about the series of shootings in this area?
Well, the suggestions are supposed to help build trust. And Phoenix police have repeatedly asked the public to call in if they see suspicious activity or just something that's unfamiliar. But if Maryvale residents don't trust the police, the chances of them calling in a tip drop significantly.
So, Matt, did police have any new information on their investigation into these shootings?
They did not. Since most of the shootings occurred on the west side, I thought talk about the serial shooter would make up a big part of the meeting. But it was only mentioned a couple of times.
Did you get any sense as to why residents didn't bring this up more?
Actually, no, I did not get a sense of that. I went in there, like I said, expecting it to be a focal part of the meeting. But one of the things, too, is that people in Maryvale have been living with this for several weeks now. When police first came out and said that they thought four shootings were connected, all of them were in Maryvale and in kind of a tight area where they were focusing on. So there have been vigils. There have been community meetings. Maryvale has had more time to get used to this than probably the rest of the city.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. I'm Mark Brody.
And with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. The U.S. is a nation of guns, where there are more guns than people.
For every 100 Americans in 2014, there were 116 guns. And that's a trend that's been rising all through the Obama administration.
There have been more guns sold since I've been president than just about any time in U.S. history. There are enough guns for every man, woman, and child in this country. And at no point have I ever proposed confiscating guns from responsible gun owners.
The president has been personally affected by this rise in gun sales, but with a population of 300 million people, it's hard for ordinary citizens to understand what that number of guns circulating means. We're going to take a stab at it, though, with help from some people who study guns in America all the time. The 538 Group, a team of journalists, investigators, and statisticians, after months of research into databases from the Centers for Disease Control, the FBI, and the University of Maryland's Global Terrorism Database, among others, 538 has put numbers and some meaning to the guns in our midst. Ben Castleman is a senior editor and the chief economics writer for 538. He says while politicians and the media like to talk about the gun deaths that shock us and anger us, mass shootings and terrorism, many, many more deaths are happening in the quiet darkness of American homes.
Nearly two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides in this country. Most of the rest are homicides, and a large percentage of those sort of fall into a category of street violence, of urban violence between and among young men. 85% of gun victims are men of one sort or another. You know, we're not going to probably solve the suicide problem by banning guns. A lot of the people who kill themselves with a gun are people who are legally allowed to own them and are probably among the last people who would be asked to give up their guns. It's a very different question when we look at something like domestic violence, where many of the perpetrators of domestic violence are people who are already prohibited from owning guns by a restraining order, and yet we have no effective mechanism to ensure that they actually give up their guns.
Is there low-hanging fruit here? Are there easy, obvious fixes to some aspects of this problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a few things that emerged. You know, if we're going to think about the gun side of this problem, then background checks are one of the things that is sort of most backed up by the research as having an effect. I think then on the other side, we have to look at solutions that aren't necessarily directly targeted at guns, but that look at issues like suicide, that look at issues like urban violence, where guns make that more deadly, but where the underlying problems don't necessarily have anything to do with the guns themselves.
Isn't it curious on the suicide question that background checks will look for a propensity to murder or to commit violent crime, but will never look for a propensity to use violence against oneself, to kill oneself, when in fact there are screening checks for precisely these kinds of suicidal behaviors?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the only sort of background check rules that are even on the table for discussion are rules to prevent people who already are legally prohibited from owning firearms from purchasing them. And so these are generally people who have been convicted of a felony or are subject to a restraining order or for some other reason. You know, there's a whole separate category of sort of whether we need to look at, you know, other markers that might suggest that somebody is at risk.
How does your study give us any insight into police violence against civilians?
In the scope of the gun problem, it is a comparatively small piece. We're talking about 1,000 mostly men killed by police each year, a few dozen police officers who are killed. But it does get at something that is larger here. I spent a few days in New Orleans reporting on their efforts to reduce homicide street crime. And one thing that becomes very clear is that there's not a trust between communities, particularly communities of color in urban environments, and the police. You know, young men of color are overwhelmingly those who die by guns, not by police necessarily, by each other in many cases, but they often don't report those crimes to police in many cases because they don't trust that police will treat them fairly. And so without that trust that needs to exist, it's going to be very difficult to address this problem in any sort of larger way.
Ben Castleman, senior editor at 538. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Phil Latzman.
Raising the minimum wage will be a hotly contested issue here in Arizona this November.
And voters in Flagstaff could be asked that question not once, but twice at the ballot box.
The group Flagstaff needs a raise as they've collected more than enough signatures for a proposal to raise the minimum wage from $8.05 to $15 an hour by the year 2021.
Meanwhile, the group Fair Wages and Healthy Families has submitted statewide signatures to ask all Arizonans whether to raise the state's minimum to $12 by 2020.
And joining us now is Joe Bader with Flagstaff Needs a Raise. So, Joe, why does Flagstaff need a raise?
Well, first of all, we think it's, wages have been flat in this country for over 30 years, as has been pointed out numerous times. In Flagstaff, we have a poverty rate of 25%, and children living in poverty is around 28%. About 25% of the jobs at Flagstaff, that's 14,000 jobs pay under $10 an hour. This has been a chronic problem in Flagstaff, given the fact that it's a tourist town, hospitality industry, which traditionally have low-wage jobs, and the minimum wage has been raised only slightly over the last 10 years.
It may create some confusion, though, because on the same ballot this November, there is likely to be an initiative asking statewide voters whether to raise the minimum wage in Arizona. So is that going to be confusing for those in Flagstaff?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. I think in the end, the citizens of Arizona and in Flagstaff are going to win no matter what happens. We think that people will vote for higher wages. We think they'll vote probably for both initiatives. We've been working on this in Flagstaff for the last year and a half, and we think that we have a loyalty among the voters in Flagstaff towards our efforts. They know the people that have been out there gathering the petitions. They follow the newspapers and the social media, and we think that they will vote for and support our initiative.
Governor Doug Ducey has threatened to penalize cities that enact their own minimum wage standards. You're going to face a lot of resistance. And that's one of those things that's going to be right in your way. How do you handle that?
Well, I think people are used to the governor issuing threats now to cities. Unfortunately, in this case, unfortunately for the governor, there's nothing he can do about the fact that the state law in Arizona now protects the rights of cities to set its own minimum wage and benefits as long as it's higher than the state minimum wage. And that's protected by the Voter Protection Act of 1998.
Joe Bader is with the group Flagstaff Needs a Raise. On the other side of the minimum wage debate is the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, which calls both proposed increases terrible ideas. Joining us now is the chamber's Senior Vice President of Government Relations, Garrick Taylor. So, Garrick, why so terrible?
Well, the sort of dramatic minimum wage hike that is being proposed both statewide and at a local level in Flagstaff is really poised to do a lot more harm than good. People at the very bottom of the career ladder and those who are outside the labor market trying to get in are going to have a much harder time thanks to this dramatic hike in the minimum wage.
The minimum wage hasn't really seen a significant increase in many years, proponents say. Would you say that any increase would be fair? And if so, what does the chamber feel would be a fair increase?
Well, there's two issues here. First of all, the Arizona minimum wage is already above the federal minimum wage. In fact, Arizona's minimum wage is adjusted annually depending on a hike in the cost of living. So the idea that Arizona is somehow lagging far behind, that just doesn't wash. The second issue is that an alternative minimum wage proposal was presented in the legislature this year. That proposal did not pass, which unfortunately leaves us with two bad options at a local level in Flagstaff and at a statewide level.
As you alluded to, it was a statewide voter initiative in 2006 that puts the current state minimum wage law in place. It does allow counties, cities, and towns by ordinance to set their own minimum wage and benefits within their boundaries.
Right.
That's what Flagstaff is trying to do, and it's what Governor Doug Ducey tried to take away from them. As you said, it failed in the legislature this past year, but should local municipalities like Flagstaff be able to set their own minimum wages?
When cities take a go-it-alone approach, it's really terrible public policy. What you could end up with is a crazy quilt of wage policies across the entire state, and it puts a significant burden on businesses that are operating in multiple jurisdictions. The idea that you should have to calibrate wages depending on zip code is nuts. And what Flagstaff is poised to do, if they advance this $15 minimum wage idea, is put up a big close for business sign.
Garrick Taylor is Senior Vice President of Government Relations at the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. Garrick, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Phil.
Phoenix is among the cities leading the way in what's called the circular economy. It's working with ASU and a nonprofit to increase its work on the concept. With me to explain is John Trujillo, Phoenix's Public Works Director.
What we're trying to do as part of the City of Phoenix is to educate and work with residents to, and as well as ourselves, to figure out ways to minimize impact that we have on our natural resources. And to do that, we're putting together what we call a resource innovation campus. And part of that campus is focusing on that circular economy, which we focus on the back end of that process, is where we collect and manage garbage and recycling.
Now, for folks who are not familiar with the phrase circular economy, what does that refer to?
Well, really, in the circular economy, the concept is that waste does not exist. And so it's designed out by attention. So there's two components of that. There's a biological component where it's non-toxic, so you can take that compostable material and invest in your natural capital, which is through composting or anaerobic digester. The other part is the technical side, and it's man-made type material. And it's non-toxic, where you can take that material and repurpose it, remanufacture, and as well as recycle back into the system.
Is this different than efforts the city of Phoenix and others have made to have zero waste?
It is different in a way. Other cities, when they focus on zero waste, what their focus is just to collect it and recycle it and not dispose of it. What our program, what we do is we educate as well to prevent the material from coming into our system. But when we do collect the material, we collect it and we sort it in a way that it could be used in a process by a business. And what's different for us is we're setting up businesses on our campus locally so we can create that circular economy local and create jobs and create revenue for the city.
Is the goal to keep everything in Phoenix as opposed to having, even if you collect recycling, to send it somewhere else?
That is our goal. Currently, the majority of our material does go to China or our landfill, which is in Buckeye. And our goal is to keep the material here locally.
What are the economics of this? Presumably, if you're building new facilities and hiring people, that's going to cost money. But I would assume also that you wouldn't be doing this if it wouldn't save the city some money as well.
Well, a good example, let's talk about palm fronds. It cost us about $17 a ton to process that material. We're going to pay palm silage $12 a ton, so we're really saving $5 per ton on that process. But that created 12 jobs. It also created millions of dollars in capital investment that they are putting into the system, not the city. We are also going to get revenue from lease that they're setting up shop right next to our transfer station, as well as they're going to be millions of dollars in tax revenue from the product that they're going to be manufacturing. So that's a good example of that circular economy and creating a local system.
How much of the success of this program hinges on residents sort of playing along?
A lot of it is dependent on residents to do the right thing and to sort the material in the right container. And that's why education and communication is going to be really key for this program to move forward.
John Trujillo, Phoenix's Public Works Director. John, thanks.
Thank you.
Last December, Camelview Movie Theaters in Scottsdale closed, and the films associated with the independent film-focused locale were moved to a new cinema nearby at Fashion Square. Theater owner Dan Harkins told us then why the move had to happen.
So really the death knell for the Camelview we know today was its death knell occurred when the city rezoned it for high-rise. And the developers said, well, why do we have this little five-plex movie theater there that pays old 1980s rent?
Fans were initially concerned about where their favorite films would go, but they also worried about the structures, including the iconic metallic mushrooms that had been in front of the building for decades. Now those mushrooms are on the move to Harkins' corporate office a couple of miles away. Architectural writer and critic Walt Lockley says the decision to preserve the mushrooms is important.
Let me say that I speak only for myself, and I have something to say to Mr. Harkins, and that is thank you. This is pretty good. You can make your own guess about how much this cost to deinstall and transport, and evidently they're going to restore those, too. They've been painted aquamarine, and originally they were rusted steel color. So originally they looked a little bit more serious than they do now.
Do you think this was because of a public groundswell, or do you think that he had some connection that he felt over all those years, too?
Well, Mr. Harkins obviously feels a connection to the theaters that he grew up in and these steel structures. They call them mushrooms. I'm not sure I like that.
what would you call
steel
them?
Parasol, yeah. They're steel columns. They're shape structures. You could call them dendriform columns. But the fact that he sees value in saving these things and taking them back to his headquarters and restoring them, I think that's pretty much where preservationists should be, because that gets the interests of the owner aligned with the interests of the people who want to defend the building, and that's why I think this is a success.
Architectural writer and critic Walt Lockley, the Camel View Mushrooms are being moved to a temporary site tonight.
Communities across Arizona are trying to find ways to deal with panhandlers. Balancing a person's free speech rights with a retailer's business environment can be challenging, but the Downtown Tempe Authority thinks it's come up with a unique way. It's launching a campaign called Mills Mission, and it starts today during happy hour. From the KJZZ Business Desk, Christina Estes reports.
That's the sound of the mash agitator.
The mash is a blend of malted barley and water. It kind of looks like a huge tub of cream of wheat.
And then we create our wort, which is the sugar solution that will become beer.
Gordon Biersch head brewer Gary Fritzy calls it a typical brew day. But what he and two other Mill Avenue brewers are making is something different, something they call Mills Mission IPA. Paul Galvin is general manager at Gordon Biersch.
Basically putting our money where our mouth is.
He's a big supporter of a recently enacted Tempe ordinance aimed at panhandling. It prohibits sitting and lying down on public sidewalks. City council members approved the ban after hearing business owners complain that panhandlers were scaring off customers. Those same merchants also promised to help those who might be homeless. And that's where Mills Mission IPA comes in.
We will have tapping parties and for fundraising purposes.
Raising money that will go to social service agencies that work with the homeless.
We're really sensitive to the citizenry and how we grow our city, I guess is the best way to put it, and how we take care of our citizens. And we want to be desirable, we want to be viable, we want to be relevant, and we can't do that by not addressing those folks that need our help. We just can't do it.
This is not a regular business for me.
More than 100 miles away in Cottonwood.
This is just a desperate way to get home.
Robert, who wouldn't give his last name, stands on a public sidewalk next to a stop sign at a busy strip mall. With a brown bag and a red gas can at his feet, his sign reads, "Please, can you help with tire, food, gas, trying to get home?"
I've been right here about maybe 2 or 3 hours. And tell the truth, it's not too good.
A couple months ago, Robert might have had better luck. He could have probably gotten a lot closer to shoppers going in and out of stores. Like Tempe, Cottonwood has launched a new program to get panhandlers away from stores. It doesn't involve fundraising, though. It's called the Safe Shopper Program. Business owners grant officers the authority to cite people for trespassing anytime they're engaged in, quote, inappropriate behaviors, like panhandling on private property. Police Chief Steve Gazelle says trespassing is a misdemeanor under state law.
That gives us the ability to compel someone to get services or face jail time.
Seems to be working.
Not far from where Robert is panhandling, Rob Harrison is stocking the shelves at Susie Q Market.
So as a business owner, that's your main concern, that they're going to cause you to lose business. I've had customers tell me that it happens, and I've had them come in and tell me that, you know, this guy just came up to me and, you know, asked me for money and he wouldn't go away.
Patrol Commander Jody McCooch manages the Safe Shopper program. In this community, there's skepticism about why people are asking for money.
The people that are panhandling are typically people that are just taking advantage of the community's goodwill or supporting some sort of habit.
He says officers have come across people who misrepresent their circumstances. In one case, a baby doll in a stroller instead of a real child. And
in one instance, there was a gentleman with an oxygen mask with the tubing that didn't go to an oxygen tank. It just hung down by his thigh.
Chief Gazelle claims many of the panhandlers are coming from outside Cottonwood and portraying themselves as homeless. But he says some are fueling an addiction, and giving them money will only hurt, not help.
When you perpetuate that type of enabling environment, the community doesn't benefit at all, and in most cases, I would say it loses.
As in Tempe, Gazelle says the money should go to social service agencies.
If you want to give, don't do it here.
As police in Cottonwood continue to promote social service agencies and protect property owners' rights, merchants along Mill Avenue in Tempe will do the same, beginning with a special brew. Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, turned 50 this year, but there are concerns that after some prime periods of public information sunshine, that kind of sharing is getting more limited by governments, and it's harder to come by for media outlets. The U of A's Journalism School Director Dave Coulier testified before a Senate panel this week and called for strengthening FOIA. He joins me with more details on that. Dave, what kinds of concerns are you hearing?
Well, what we're hearing from journalists all around the country, and citizens for that matter, is just more and more secrecy and difficulty in finding out what the government's up to. So FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, are taking forever. Delays go on for months, sometimes years. And then when people finally get the records, they're often blacked out, or most of the time, they get nothing. In fact, more than three-quarters of the time you put in a FOIA request, you'll get nothing, or they'll tell you they can't find the records. So it's a huge problem, particularly in journalism, but really for everybody.
You testified to the Senate that laws related to FOIA don't have any teeth. That's how you put it. What would you do about that?
If you can get away with breaking the law, you just might do that. And that's what a lot of government agencies do. They know there are no repercussions, so why not just ignore a person asking for records? So it's a huge problem. Our laws have been whittled and whittled through the years, added exemptions. Government agencies have gotten very adept at gaming the system, of using it actually as a tool of secrecy, not transparency. And it just, frankly, it's getting harder and harder for journalists and citizens and watchdog groups to get at this information. Ironically, you would think with technology and digitization that it'd be easier to get information that matters, government information. But in reality, it's actually harder now.
Something else you said in your testimony, it was an exchange you had with Senator Al Franken, was that Russia's Freedom of Information Act is actually stronger than the U.S. What about that? Is that real?
Well, yeah. I mean, our law has fallen behind, frankly. Now, of course, access to information in Russia is probably not ideal. I mean, I haven't been there, but my guess is Russia, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan is probably not the freest of societies, but I could be wrong. But the reality is their laws are better than ours. And now just because they have strong laws doesn't mean they're carried out well. But, you know, a good starting point is to have a strong law. And our laws have not kept up. And there's a reason for that. You know, part of it is we're one of the first countries to create a Freedom of Information law 50 years ago this month. And so it's kind of old. It's tattered. It's been fixed up here and there. But it's kind of fallen behind. It suffers from like salary compression at a workplace, whereas these other countries that have just created laws, they get to start fresh and they get to create new ones that have been improved upon. You know, I liken it to having a 1966 Ford Mustang. It's a classic. It's a great car. But if I were to buy a 2016 Hyundai, it'd probably have better gas mileage, reliability, safety features, sound. You got it. You know, right now we have a Ford Mustang that's 50 years old. Either we could trade up and get something new, or we have to just keep giving it an overhaul.
Dave, how much of FOIA's current challenges may actually have to do with budget cuts so that there are fewer people to take care of requests?
Well, definitely I think government agencies struggle with that, especially since the recession. It's a lower priority when you, let's say your police department. I mean, your number one priority is law enforcement. It's not processing paperwork. So I get it that little funding is put toward this sort of thing. But, you know, it's just the part of doing business as a government agency. We, as taxpayers, pay for them to do business, for them to create documents, for them to create records of what they do so we can see and make sure that they're doing the job that we're paying them to do. So, yeah, they're understaffed. They need to be staffed better. That's definitely an issue that has to be addressed. And that's something I suggested to Congress they do is, you know, the freedom of information is not free. You have to put the money up to do it right. Otherwise, the public have no way of knowing what's going on. And we, if we want to make democracy work, we got to know.
That's U of A's Journalism School Director Dave Coulier. We've been talking about 50 years of FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act.
Arizona voters will be able to cast their ballot for the Green Party's presidential candidate, even though the party missed a key deadline. With me to explain is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. And Howie, what exactly happened here?
Here's the issue. As you know, voters don't vote for candidates. They actually vote for a slate of electors. And in Arizona, the slate of electors, which is chosen by the party chair, has to be in by June 1st, even before you know who the candidate officially is going to be. Well, the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Libertarians got a slate of candidates in. The Green Party didn't. Angel Torres, who's the party chairman, said, well, they didn't tell us. And of course, the issue is it's not the responsibility of the Secretary of State to tell you what the law requires. So the party said, well, we don't think it's fair. We think the deadline's too early. And they went to federal court and sued. What has happened is that the state has decided, well, maybe they have a point. Now, we can't on ourselves ignore the June 1st deadline. We can't say the law doesn't mean what the law means. However, if a federal judge were to tell us that the June 1st deadline can be ignored in this case, and we won't fight that, then they get to be on the ballot. And so they've entered into a stipulation to allow the Green Party to put its electors on the ballot now.
And has the judge signed off on that?
This is sitting on the judge's desk. The judge is, I think, reviewing it. I can't see any reason why a judge would turn down a stipulation. I mean, this isn't like some plea bargain where the judge said, well, that sentence isn't harsh enough. You've got an agreement by both sides. You know, why have a trial?
Why did the Secretary of State's office decide that maybe the Green Party was right on this?
Well, I think they recognized that to have a June 1st deadline for a general election ballot, and I recognize they have to be printed early and they go out to overseas voters early, it was hard to justify. And this way, at least, they're not defeated. You don't have a ruling overturning the law. Instead, you just have saying this year for this party will accept it. Now, Michelle Reagan has said, you know, maybe they have a point, maybe the deadline's a little early, so I will work with the legislature next year to see maybe we should put it back to July 1st or some other date. She hasn't exactly said when.
Obviously, Secretary of State Reagan has had, let's call it an interesting few months as far as elections and election laws go. Do you get the sense that any of what's happened over the past several weeks played into this decision in any way?
Well, I think when, as you point out, that office has been a little snake bit over issues of things that were her fault, like not getting out certain brochures, maybe were not her fault, like the long lines in the presidential primary. Perhaps you look to avoid, you know, fights, you know, after getting bloodied and beat up. You say, do I really want to fight this one? Do I really want to have our attorneys go into court and justify an unjustifiable deadline? And I think saner minds prevailed on this one.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
Glad to provide some input.
There have been two federal court rulings over the past 2 weeks dealing with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and specifically the use of passwords. The first case, U.S. v. Nozzle, centered on whether a former employee could use a current employee's username and password without the company's knowledge and permission. The second, Facebook v. Power Ventures, dealt with the social media aggregation site's collection of users' passwords. For more on these cases and what they mean for letting friends and family use your Hulu password, I'm joined by Jamie Williams, an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is a digital rights nonprofit. Jamie, first off, what did you make of these rulings?
There's slightly different contexts, but what's interesting about the cases is not only that they come so close together in time, but that in the first case, the court's reasoning applies very broadly. And if you take the court's reasoning in Nozzle 2, because it was the second time Nozzle went to the Ninth Circuit, to its logical conclusion, because the decision is all turned around who can give authorization. And the court said, a computer owner needs to give authorization to someone to access a computer system. An account holder, a computer user, can't give authorization, is what the court seemed to be saying. And so that would have criminalized all sorts of common behavior that we do every day involving password sharing. People log into other people's network, Netflix accounts, email accounts, bank accounts. People do this for completely legitimate reasons with the complete consent and authorization and permission, and sometimes at the request of other people. And so in the second decision in Facebook versus Power, the court's reasoning there limited the first decision in a way, because the court acknowledged as a user, a Facebook user, could give authorization to somebody else to use their account. And so in that way, the second decision limits the first decision and seems to be taking a step back from criminalizing password sharing.
Well, it seemed like there was quite a bit of consternation online about, you know, if you gave somebody your Hulu account or your Netflix account or your Spotify account, that you could end up going to prison for that.
Yeah, there was definitely, I mean, there was an entire week between when the initial Nozzle or the second Nozzle decision was released last week and the second CFA decision was released this week. And during that time, we had this one decision that seemed to be saying that all, that seemed to be making a criminal out of every single person who had ever used someone else's password without the approval of their computer owner. And that raised alarms for many people, and I think rightfully so. But now that we have the second decision, which limits the first decision slightly, and I think the only logical conclusion that we can draw from the new decision is that you can give someone authorization, and the court didn't mean to actually criminalize all password sharing outright.
Do you think this is a case where Congress needs to tighten this law up a little bit, maybe as technology has changed and the kinds of things for which we use passwords has evolved?
Yeah, I definitely think that this is a very old statute. It was passed in 1986. This was a very fear-based thing way before we knew how computers would function today and how connected our lives would be and how we would be using and accessing other people's computers every single day, every time we log into our email, etc. And the law is, part of the reason the law is so vague is because it was passed so early, and it has created lots of problems. Security researchers have been deterred from publishing research findings for fear of CFAA liability. The statute was intended to target hacking, and it should be limited in that way. And if that's what Congress was trying to do, and that is what Congress was trying to do, Congress should go back and fix the language and give us something that actually makes sense for where we are today.
Jamie Williams is an attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For a lot of the country, this is peak season for the golfing industry, but here in the Southwest, it's just the opposite. High temperatures keep golfers off the links, while water and upkeep costs strain maintenance budgets. The show's Jimmy Jenkins has this report on how courses in hot climates try to make ends meet.
Great shot there, Dennis. At the Tournament Players Club in Scottsdale, it's noon, and the temperature on the first tee, 105 degrees. This kind of weather brings out two types of golfers, the passionate, like Dennis Binaco.
I don't play in the rain, and I won't play when it's cold, but when it's hot, I'll play all the time.
And the, shall we say, thrifty, like Arkot Premkumar.
Price is the most important thing. And
it's because he's cheap.
I mean, everybody likes a nice deal.
And today, Premkumar is getting a great deal. In peak season, the fall and winter, it costs more than $300 to play here. But in the summer, 18 holes in a cart will only set you back $85. Course pro Doug Hodge says it's a chance for higher handicappers to play on the same turf as the greatest in the game.
Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Jordan Spieth played here in 15, Jason Day, the list goes on and on.
But it costs a lot to keep a championship course looking green in the middle of the desert.
We need to do everything we can every day to maximize green fee cart fee revenues. Even a little bit of revenue is better than none for our operation.
Like a lot of courses, the Players Club uses an online booking service to fill tee times. Will McIntosh is with the booking service Golf Now.
We make their tee time inventory available to golfers so that they can search for the particular date and time that they want to play golf.
So 6 a.m. on Saturday, when the temperature is only 95 degrees, will cost you more than noon on Sunday. But for smaller courses, the grass isn't always as green. In fact, at the Apache Sun Golf Club east of Phoenix, the fairways are completely brown. Superintendent Rory Van Pocky closes the course every summer from May to October and lets the grass die.
We close to reduce our water cost and reduce our expenses to maintain a profitable operation.
But Van Pocky says his fairways will be green again and ready for the snowbirds' return this fall. For the show, I'm Jimmy Jenkins.
Whether it's the Hopi tradition of running or the Algonquin invention of lacrosse, sports and athletics have a long history in Native American culture. So why are there so few Native athletes in the Olympics? The show's Annika Klein explores that question.
Billy Mills is one of the best-known Native American Olympic athletes. In an incredible upset in 1964, Mills of the Sioux tribe grabbed the gold in the 10,000-meter run. Another name you might know is Jim Thorpe, a Sac and Fox Indian who took home the gold in the pentathlon and the decathlon in 1912.
1912, even though that was 100 years ago, seemed to be the high point of representation of Native athletes.
When only 6 Native American athletes competed. Jim Adams is the senior historian at the National Museum of the American Indian. He says many of these early athletes, including Thorpe and Mills, went to Indian boarding schools. White coaches at schools like the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania had connections to the Olympic Games.
Carlisle sent about 5 people over to the Olympics in the 1908 and 1912 and had the support of the training, providing transportation, all the expenses, which are considerable for Olympic participation.
After the era of boarding schools, Native communities didn't have the same inroads to the Olympics. Adams says from the start of the Games through 2010, there have been just 43 Olympic athletes who identify as Native American or Aboriginal Canadian. That's the thundering of volleyballs hitting hands at the Lori Paiestewa National Native American Games. On the far court, the Tuba City Starlings are neck and neck with another team. The tournament is an annual multi-sport event that's been called the Olympics of Indian Country. Almost all the athletes here are Native, many from reservation towns.
It's just a lot of traveling for us.
That's Starlings coach April Claremont.
So from Tuba City, we are about 3-4 hours away from the valley. So when we start in January, we travel twice a month down here to the valley.
Travel and funding for teams have been challenges since she started playing in third grade. But traveling is important because it gives the team visibility off the reservation.
It's really, really deeply embedded into all of us, the kind of awareness that we're not represented at a level that, other ethnicities are represented at mainstream sports.
Vincent Schilling is the sports editor for Indian Country Today, a national outlet for Native American news. His team reports on Native athletes, and he says athletes are now representing themselves through social media.
It is critical that our young people do take advantage of things like social media to get their voices out there, because their voices are being heard.
Whenever I play on the court, everything just goes away and I could feel a sense of stress relief.
14-year-old Jada Chi plays for the Starlings. Coach Claremont is actually her mom.
She'd yell at me and then I'd cry.
She's fine, and mom's very intense when it comes to volleyball, but she's adapted and she's doing really well.
And that's not just a mom talking up her kid. Jada is doing well. This week she's in Colorado Springs for a Team USA invitational program for volleyball. And hopefully one day she'll be on the Olympic team herself. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.